Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
You're listening to Item 13, an African food podcast, and I'm your host, Yom Akuaku. Every week, we'll delve into the delicious world of African food, including chefs, curators, and bloggers. Here's the show.
Welcome to the show, Tapiwa. I'm excited to have you on this week. I think this is going to be an insightful conversation for everyone that's listening. It's going to be a little bit personal, but then I think it's also going to be enlightening in terms of the work that both, I guess, you and I are trying to do in the food space. And so we'll talk a little bit about food, because that's kind of what the audience is expecting. But then we're going to give some context to what it means in the greater scheme of things. And so welcome. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me. Yeah, this is exciting. I like the direction you are taking with your work, so I'm glad to be part of that story. Yeah.
Great. Okay, so we'll start with you sort of sharing who you are. Who is Tapiwa? As much or as little as you want to share about yourself.
Can we do a mini series, like 16 episodes?
Yeah.
So I am a Zimbabwean born and raised tinkerer, I suppose, is how I would describe myself. I like to do a little bit of everything. I don't believe my purpose is single fold. I believe I'm here to tackle as much as possible and then die. So part of that is food, part of that is sex education, part of that is health and well-being, movement, art, calligraphy. I like to create my own like scripts and symbology. I try to do everything. So I'm pretty like making leather work and whatever. I try to do a little bit of everything. So who I am is open-ended.
That's cool. That's cool. That's interesting. And it's almost, when I think about the way we are raised, you know, as children, everybody asks you, what do you want to be when you grow up? And it's like, you have to have this specific answer of, this is the thing that I'm going to be, or, you know, this is, and half of the time you don't even know what that means. and it feels like that quote unquote pressure starts really early on in terms of defining who you're going to be. And that in itself can be dangerous in some ways, I think, but that's awful. That's good. Good context to get started. And, because you're Zimbabwean and you're the first Zimbabwean person I've had on the podcast, I wanted us to talk a little bit about Zimbabwean food and Zimbabwean flavors before we get into the meat of our conversation. So when we say Zimbabwean food, like what does that mean? What are the staple foods that you have compared to, I guess, the rest of the continent or the rest of the world? What stands out? What's different in terms of the food itself? And then the culture around the food, how you guys eat, drink, celebrate with food, etc.
So a huge part of my approach to life, right, is embracing diversity and in as many ways as possible. So I'll start off by saying Zimbabwean tribes, we have, I think, about 16 recognized official tribes and then some non-recognized tribes. So there is no such thing really as Zimbabwean food. In the same way, there's no such thing as African food, you know. It's going to be tribal cuisines. And there's a lot of overlap. Mm-hmm. And obviously, We have Ndebele people who are descended from people who came from South Africa. So that's more of the Nguni aspect of Bantu tribes. Then we have Kore Kore people, Rozi people, Zezuru people, who kind of came down. We're talking Uganda, Rwanda, Kenya, Tanzania, all the way down to Zimbabwe. So you can see aspects of East African kind of food, in the East African kind of language. But before that, those people, I think, are Nilotic, when they came from like way further up. So it's a complicated question. But having said that, there are some dishes that are, or certainly ingredients that are quite universal within the country. And obviously, and this pains me to admit this all the time, but maize is a big part of our food culture. But it's not really, to me, it's not part of our food culture. It's part of Mexican food culture that has been brought over here. And it doesn't really, a lot of the technology that goes together with eating maize that the Mexicans have didn't translate across when they came here. So from a point of nutrition, eating maize is not a good thing in an African context because we don't have the technology to understand that ingredient and process that ingredient. But we have a bunch of our own grains here, like teff, like sorghum, like millet, like literally hundreds of varieties of all these different grains that I grew up eating, certainly, but aren't as glamorous as like bleached, refined white maize meal and and you know, like wheat flour or like barley flour, those kind of things.
Right.
And same with cassava as well. Cassava is another South American plant, but again, it's heavier on the continent. So there's a lot of blending of South American ingredients and a lot of Asian ingredients that came across with the early explorers, shall we say. But from my childhood and from my context as my tribal connections is there's a huge component of using peanut butter in the cooking. So it's like a nice universal seasoning for me. So in a savory and sweet context. So peanut butter and rice, peanut butter and chicken, peanut butter and dried meat that's been recooked, peanut butter and greens, peanut butter... obviously on a sandwich, but in porridge, in porridge with like pureed pumpkin. I can't think of, even like dried fish. I can put peanut butter in anything because we have a history of it. Peanut butter and cow peas or black eyed peas, whatever you call them. And if you're West African, you're going to have that black eyed pea connection, obviously.
Right.
Yeah. So we put peanut butter. Suddenly, my people put peanut butter with everything.
Okay.
And then we have a lot of gourd-based cooking. So like calabash and pumpkin and butternut. Again, things are not really from here. And the really predominant flavors that I can think of are the wild fruits and the wild plants, which typically are consumed as is or consumed as medicine. And very rarely are they really processed or transformed. I grew up eating fresh things close to how they are as possible. Yeah.
I was going to say, and that's unfortunate that we are losing that part of our culture, you know, in terms of eating fresh food. Just because I remember so distinctly when I first moved to the States around when I was 18 or 19. And just, I know for the first several months, I could not stomach American food because of how processed it was. Like, it did not sit well with me at all. And I had to petition. So the college I was at required that you lived on campus for the first 2 years. That meant also that you had to pay for the cafeteria food as part of that package. And so I had to petition to like move out of the dorms because your dorm living was tied to the cafeteria. There were no kitchens or like waste. There was no way to cook in the living areas. And so, like, I had to have an extraordinary petition to move out because, you know, I sort of overplayed how I was homesick and blah, blah, blah to get out of that. So I could cook, so I could actually cook, you know, not just cook food from home, but have like that fresh food, the money I was saving. Cause then it was just, and then I think it was also over, was made worse by the fact that I worked part-time in the cafeteria. And so I knew how that food was made. And a lot of it was just big packages that would be, you know, was being cooked just for efficiency's sake. So nothing was being made fresh, right? And so the fact that I could see, quote unquote, how the sausage is being made, and then the fact that it just didn't sit well with me, was tough. And so it's unfortunate that we've moved away. We're increasingly moving away from that in the name of development or
progress.
I just
remembered a few dishes whilst you were talking.
I feel like that
could be different to other people's experience. So there's a dish called rupiza, which is black-eyed peas, but we like grind them, but like stone grind them into like a paste kind of, and then you cook them to make, it feels a bit like a peanut butter sauce, like a, almost like a paste. Then you eat that with like some kind of starch. And there's also ruatata, and that's essentially like cooked blood, so it almost makes like a little cake, but it's like savory. So you cook the blood down until most of the liquid is gone, and you get this sort of flaky, I don't even know how to describe this in English with English words, but it's essentially you're making almost like you're trying to make meat out of blood. So you treat it as meat for the dish, so you can
and this is ruatata. Got it. Okay, great. I will look that up. I wanted to talk about, before we talk about the work you've done with Tapi, just my experience. So now you live in South Africa now, and I remember when I lived in South Africa for 2 years, Joburg specifically, for 2 years for work. And I remember being extremely disappointed in like the offerings for like African food, or even, man, maybe it was a function of where I lived in Johannesburg, but I was also disappointed that like local food wasn't as prevalent. Like, I feel like if I go to Lagos, if I go to Accra, I don't have to be in certain parts of the city to get access to good local food. And I found everywhere, like all the, from like if I wanted a simple meal to like quote unquote fine dining, it was all so-called continental food. And it was extremely disappointing because I fought so hard to get a South Africa assignment because I wanted that experience. Like I want, from a food perspective at least, I wanted the experience of, you know, Southern. And even I know that there's a lot of people from Kenya that moved down. So wanted that Eastern African flavor too. And it was incredibly disappointing. The only time I had a meal with one of two times, I would say one was being in Soweto, where, but even then it's like touristy Soweto, right? So they are making all these braais and whatnot for the tourist population, which is fine. But then the best meal, and that this was Pan-African, and I don't know if you know Sanza, who is based in Yeovil, who does this Pan-African dinner. Pan-African
I've heard
dinners
of them.
And for me that was it was eye-opening in a lot of, like, going into Yeovil, and I don't know how much you know about Joburg in particular, but going into Yeovil is an experience in its of its own. So it's, for those who are listening that are not familiar, Yeovil is it's outside of the main Joburg city. It's where a lot of West African and I would say other African immigrants live, it's not considered to be the safest of neighborhoods. But this is where you probably find the most vibrant cultures in terms of food and the way people interact with each other. It reminded me of home in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. But then you also had to be very careful, one, because that there was a lot of tension between West Africans and local South Africans, and just the reputation of the area wasn't great. But Sanza, who is based in Yeovil, provides this communal dining experience where it's truly Pan-African. So he has, you know, these dinners where he invites people over. You helped him to prepare the table a little bit, so it feels like a family dinner. And he does this explanation of the he does this Pan-African fusion, which I love, because when people talk about fusion, they're always fusing Italian or French with our food. But he does this Pan-African fusion so well. Like he will do like a West African pea thing with like a North African bread. And it was just the way he spoke about it, and even the way he talked about, which is something I wanted to talk to you about when we moved to talk about tapi tapi and ice cream, is that he also talked about his respect for the ingredients and the way to cook them from the different places in Africa and how he learned how to make them so that he was honoring those traditions. And so he would say, for example, walking down the streets of Yeovil, he would smell something and he would follow the smell and he'd find this woman cooking in the corner. She was making this Liberian thing, and he would ask her to teach him. And so he would go over like every week until he sort of mastered the dish the best he could, and then he would introduce that new dish to his communal dinner. And so for me, that was probably hands down around the world one of my best dining experiences ever.
That is beautiful.
And it speaks to sort of the work that you and I in some ways are trying to do in terms of education. So he does a lot of educating about cultures because he talks about the food in the context of culture. He also honors, he's very open about the fact that I'm South African. Like, this is not necessarily, like, these specific things are not necessarily native to, like, who I am. But I'm also African in the sense that I, like, we are one people. And then he talks about the you know, history of colonization and all. Like, he brings it together so beautifully. And then the way that the dining is done, and that it's family style, it's the way we eat. It's just, it's one of, you know, it's, he does this in his own little community somewhere, but it's just a fantastic, fantastic experience. I will go from that. I'll switch gears from that. I think you'll see the connection to Sanza's story when we start talking about more of Tapiwa's work and the scope of what he's trying to do with respect to food. So let's start quickly with the obvious so that we can move forward. So Tapi Tapi ice cream, what was your impetus for starting that? And then it sounds like it's from the name, it sounds like it's something you derive from your name. But if you could tell us also, like, what Tapi Tapi literally means, as well as, you know, your inspiration to start it.
Sure thing. So Tapi Tapi, kutapira is the verb for something being sweet. So Tapi Tapi is saying sweet, sweet, sweet. It's like saying yum yum or bon bon, you know, it's like saying something like that. But okay. Specifically referring to sweetness. So if you have like a nice jam sandwich, like, ooh, tapi tapi, cool tapira. You know, that's emphasizing the fact that it's like so sweet and delicious and tasty. And I'd always wanted to be involved in food in some way, shape or form, because I grew up cooking in my grandmother's house. And in particular, I grew up making sweet things, like baking. We used to bake together a lot. And
interesting.
So when I came to varsity to Cape Town, South Africa, I used to like sell little cakes and whatnot to make like pocket money. We call it pocket money. A little bit of
yeah, me too.
A little bit of change for whatever shenanigans. And during my study years, things got a bit too intense. I was too focused on the studying, so I stopped really cooking. I was just eating as a function of survival. And in my postgrad years now, so graduate school, is that what you say in America?
Yeah, graduate school, yeah. I always need to learn how to like move from, especially when I go home, to move from American English to like British English, because some of these words, like when I'm in America, it's elevator. When I'm at home, it's a lift. It's
like a... When I moved to postgraduate level, I suddenly had a bit more time and I had scholarship money, so I could afford to buy nicer, not nicer, but a different range of ingredients to cook with. So I started exploring different cuisines, South American cuisines, Asian cuisines, European cuisines, Mediterranean cuisines. And I started doing whatever I could to just learn about different cultures. But in all that, I never bothered experimenting with food from this continent. And, ooh, hold on a second. Okay, cool. My earphones had done something weird there. Sorry.
Okay, that's fine.
So in that time where I'd been experimenting with global cuisine, I'd almost like made an extra effort to not explore African food cultures at all. And it was this huge gaping hole in my newfound focus. I was like, oh, what are they doing in Japan? What are they doing in Italy? And I never looked to say, oh, what are they doing in South Africa where I live? So fast forward, finished postgrad, did master's, PhD. And during the PhD years, I started making a lot of ice cream. And again, I was still just doing ice creams from other places. And I was trying to always find the next exotic ingredient. Oh, dragon fruit. Oh, let's try thyme and honey. Oh, basil and pine nuts, whatever. Let's keep pushing the envelope with what we can do with ice cream.
Yeah. You know?
And then in 2018, so at that point, I've been making ice cream for about 8 years in 2018. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Just for fun at home. I went to Indonesia. And while I was there, I noticed a lot of parallels between how I was raised and how some of the Indonesian people live. Very content, kind of simple life. You are happy with whatever that you have. And that's how I kind of grew up. And that reaffirmed or brought me back to the way I was raised with my family. And I decided, oh my goodness, why does it keep swapping between the two different earphones? Do you have any idea?
I can still hear you okay. So if...
Okay, it's back now again. I don't know why it's doing that.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
This is weird. But sorry. So in any case, when I was in Indonesia, I noticed this overlap between how they lived and how I'd been raised. So I was now really sort of reconnecting with my identity. And then I come back a week later, my grandmother passed away and she had been like my food mentor. So I went back home to Zimbabwe. And in that time, I took a lot of time to think about what I was doing with my life. And I was now doing my postdoctoral fellowship in South Africa. And the research I was doing was moving more and more away from the continent. I was working on making plants from South America, making plants from Asia, making plants from Europe grow better in an African context. Instead of saying, how can I improve on the crops that are from here so that they do better in our context, right. You know? So I was suddenly like really disillusioned about the work that I was doing. And I was like, no, this makes no sense. But on top of that, as a scientist, there was a delay between the amount of time it was taking for us to connect to people. The point for me of science is to obtain new knowledge and share it with as many people as is possible. But what the reality can be is you obtain new knowledge and you share it with other scientists. And then you move on and you add to that knowledge pool, but it's not accessible,
yeah.
Right? So now I had this really urgent feeling that I was doing the wrong kind of work. I'm still a scientist, but I was not doing what I wanted to be doing with the science. And then, so 2018, I started the company as a way to just sell some ice cream. And I was still making the same old flavors. I started experimenting with the fermentation of ice cream, beer flavored ice cream, cocktails, you know, trying to get a gimmick going to explain to people the difference. You'll never really know this difference until you've had homemade ice cream. And I was trying to explain to people, buy my ice cream because it's really good. They're like, yeah, I can get Häagen-Dazs. I'm like, no, you haven't had ice cream. You've had what you think is good ice cream. But if you've never had ice cream someone made for you at home, you haven't had ice cream, you know? So I was trying to find this, all these little gimmicks to convince people to buy into what I was doing. And then maybe 2 months later, I was in a Zimbabwean restaurant, a Shona restaurant in South Africa. And I saw some snacks from home. And for the first time, I was like, hey, why don't I put some of that in my ice cream? And I made 5 flavors inspired by home. And that was the first time I tasted ice cream that reminded me of my people, that evoked emotion, that evoked nostalgia, that took me back to specific memories, as opposed to, oh, I remember the last time I had strawberry ice cream, it was delicious, versus, oh, shit, this is summer in Zimbabwe, right? Oh, this tastes like my grandmother's house. Oh, this tastes like my mother's cooking. Oh, this tastes like whatever. It was the first time I felt like I had created something that was true to me. And I was like, okay, I've got it. I've got my gimmick. And it was still a gimmick. I was like, haha, I know how to make money from this thing now, right? And then fast forward a few more months, I had an event in September. Around about this time now, actually, So around Heritage Day in South Africa, there's something called Heritage Day, which I want to touch on a little bit later, the problems with that. But for now, for now, I did a Heritage Day event where I did a 9-course tasting menu with 9 different ice cream flavors from Zimbabwe.
Ooh.
All right. And it was in my friend's house, very small, intimate, 20 people. And what I found in that space was, for the first time, people felt seen by a menu. This is very rare in Cape Town for Black people to feel seen by a menu.
Yeah.
Right. In South Africa, yes, but Cape Town, it's really, really...
Cape Town especially.
Outrageous.
Cape Town is very, I mean, I will say it, it's very white. Yeah. Like, I've been to Cape Town several times, and it's very... It doesn't even feel like Africa in a lot of ways.
No, it feels like in Spain or like some,
right?
So it was the first time I noticed something quite powerful. So there were some Zimbabweans and some non-Zimbabweans in the room, right? So I would serve a course. I'd be like, okay, this is nopi. This is a dish inspired by pumpkin and peanut butter from my people. My grandmother used to make this for me. It's a very special dish for me, and on and on and on and on. Then I would leave to go prepare the next course. The other Zimbabweans are like, oh, actually, I'm from southeastern Zimbabwe. We have nopi, but it's not made this way. We don't use peanut butter. We use the seeds from bitter lemon, melon, or we use blah, 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 blah. So now you're having this cultural exchange. People are getting excited. People are like, oh my goodness, this is so familiar and yet so different. And then I realized I can't tell this story by myself. It's even better when it's told by other people in the room. If I can facilitate a space where this conversation can happen organically without like, okay, today's subject material is blah, blah, blah. Just loosely guide that conversation. Magic is going to happen. So then I started doing these monthly events. Each month I would do a different country or different theme. And so the next month, I think I did South Africa. And I took an ingredient, a plant here called impepo, which is sacred to a lot of the tribes here. They're using a lot of their cultural practices. In addition to being a medicinal plant, in addition to being an insecticide, a bunch of different things. But it was the first time all of them in attendance had seen it as an edible product. I put into ice cream and I put into a cake and I combined the two for a dessert. And some people were like, oh, you're bastardizing our culture. Some people were like, oh, this is amazing. I didn't know you could eat this plant. But the consequence of that was conversation was happening.
Right.
And they felt truly seen because I used this ingredient and I also explained its significance. And I use it in the way that they know as well. So we burn it as part of the ceremony before an event. You burn it to invoke your ancestors into a space to join you in this celebration. in this grieving, in this mourning, whatever ritual you're about to partake in,
right,
you burn this plant. So they're like, oh, even this Zimbabwean guy is paying attention to me more than I pay attention to myself, you know, or more than other restaurants here pay attention to my people, to my tribe, because all we get here is pizza. We have burgers. There's no representation except for, you know, when you go to like the hood and you go find food in the hood from people in the hood. That's the only time you really engage with authentic food. If you go to a quote-unquote African restaurant in the sort of mainstream areas, it's going to be white-owned, gentrified for tourists.
Right.
You know, like that difference between like eating Chinese food versus going with a Chinese person to where they buy food from Taiwan.
Yeah.
Right? That's a very different experience. So in that moment, people are getting emotional. People are crying. And I'm like, oh, this is not a gimmick. This is not a gimmick. This is power. This is education. This is empowerment. This is nostalgia. This is representation. This is decolonization. This is something you cannot buy. This is something you cannot manufacture. This is real lives feeling touched, feeling connection, feeling represented. I was like, I have found my purpose. And that purpose is not developing. But what I'm realizing is there is a collective damage that's been done to the continent's self-esteem. It's ubiquitous. Different tribes have a different balance with it, and different countries as well. But it's undeniable that colonization has fractured our ego to the point you don't even realize it until someone shows you, hey, this is you. Wake up. And now the focus of all my work, including Tapi Tapi, but beyond Tapi Tapi, is to rehabilitate that ego, to rehabilitate that esteem, to say you are good enough, you are worthy, your beliefs, your practices, your food, your identity, your clothing, your textiles, your art, your very being is phenomenal. It's amazing. It comes from a long time ago, before 1488, when the first settlers came here. It comes from the beginning. All of life comes from this place. You are from the very beginning of life on this planet as a human species. You are undeniable. Your origins are potent, but you have no freaking clue how significant you are, how powerful you are. So it's about, how do we move forward beyond the food? How do we move forward as a person who identifies as an African in all your being, everything, like your sexuality, your belief systems, your mathematics, your science, whatever it is that you do? How can you embrace your identity to say, yes, I'm a scientist. Yes, I'm a practitioner of whatever. How can I tie that to my identity and add that to my culture and bring my culture forward? Not by abandoning it, but by adding to your culture, contributing to the culture, contributing to the legacy. I am this person. This is what I'm good at. I want to add to the story. How do I do that as Tapi Tapi? And how do I help other people do that in their own spaces, in their own work? Because it's not a journey. It's not a fight I'm going to do alone. It's not a journey. It's not a fight that's going to happen in my generation. I'm doing this for millennia down the line. I'm doing it for our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren, the children I will never see. I will never have children myself because I've chosen not to. But I'm doing this work for other little black kids and adults. That's what Tapi Tapi is about.
Wow, that's so powerful. And it's so funny because I actually didn't even expect it to share this, or it's maybe to share it in this way. But when you talk about, you know, seeing the value in who we are and what we bring to the table, so earlier this year I was invited to this food conference thing to speak on a panel. about building, what was the title? Building a Sustainable Food Network, right? Super broad range, blah, blah. But I was invited to a specific panel, I think about, I forget the title, but whatever. And then maybe a couple of months. So I was invited late last year, actually. And then towards the end of the year, early this year, they sent me an invitation that, oh, up and further review, blah, blah, blah. They think I would make for, I would be better suited to be a keynote speaker, or to be the keynote speaker. And my first thought was, who am I? Like, what? Because first of all, this was happening in, North, this is not happening in New York or LA or some cosmopolitan city, right? This is happening in Raleigh, North Carolina, which is not incredibly diverse. So in my
That's
mind,
in the South,
I'm
right?
speaking to, yeah, I would say, yeah, close to the South, yeah. It has a Southern, it's close enough to the South that it's a lot of Southern culture, yeah. So that was my first inkling. I was, you know, if it was New York or something, I'd be like, okay, the mix of the crowd would make me feel a little bit more comfortable. But here I am thinking most of my experience has been in the African food space. And these people are talking about probably like more, you know, rural farming or like American food systems. Like, what do I have to contribute? Especially talking about, you know, sustainability and all this stuff. But it was funny. I told my friends that it's interesting that this happened in January, because one of the things I had come, you know, in, like around the beginning of the year, you make your resolutions for better or for worse. And one of the resolutions I had made was to say yes more often to opportunities that allow me to tell our stories. And so it's funny in that, you know, whether you believe in God or the universe, like that alignment happened like as quickly as I made the resolution. And so it was difficult for me to say no, because I had just made that promise or commitment to myself. So I said yes, but I didn't know sort of in which direction I was going to go. And as I spent more time, because then I started doing research about like American system, rural farming, the things they do, blah, blah, blah. And then I could sort of feel that disconnect, because I'm like, this is not me. This is another thing I know. Like, what, you know, what is this? This is something that they know, and, you know, it's their culture or whatever. So I switched gears and decided to talk about what I knew about sustainability. I talked about, you know, growing up, how we prepared food, how small, you know, smallholder farming was like a thing, which is just, it's more sustainable than, you know, corporate large farming that's prevalent in America. I talked about, you know, this idea of recycling and reusing all parts of food, which is native, which is common to us, like just by virtue of our no waste mindsets, like you use all parts of the animal, you use all parts of the vegetable, going to the market, and my mom speaking to the market woman who could tell you what farm, you know, their tomatoes were coming from, or which fisherman brought in, you know, this catch of fish. That connection to our food that Americans are looking for today in terms of local, organic, or whatever, it's always been with us. And so, like, I was able to make that connection. So I spoke about what I knew, right, in terms of, like, my personal experience growing up. And then I tied it to examples of things people were doing on the continent that I was aware of in terms of both farming and food and all of that. And I remember, like, I try not to look at the audience. I'm looking at the back of the audience as I speak, because I don't want their reaction to influence what I'm saying. And the feedback afterwards was like out of this world, because for a lot of those people, one, they never consider what they were doing in the context. Like, Africa is not even on their radar, right? And so they're like, oh, can you connect me to this company that you mentioned that's doing XYZ? Can you tell me a little bit more about this grain? I talked about Fonio and, you know, what that means in terms of the movements around gluten-free and blah, 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 and that a lot of our grains, like millet, sorghum, fonio, are naturally gluten-free and all of the stuff. So where can I find fonio and blah, blah, blah? And, like, I haven't thought about this in a while, but, you know, the what you were sharing right now brought that all back to me, and how, even with me, it took that moment of self-reflection. And who knows, maybe if I'd been in March or April with like COVID and all that happening, maybe I would have said no. But the timing of that and that ability to recognize that we have something to offer, mm-hmm. That other people may not appreciate, or may not even appreciate because they don't know about. And so that recognition, that self-esteem you talk about, I think, is going to be really crucial in this movement. One, to recognize it in ourselves, and then to think about then how we contribute that to the rest of the world. I think this is a good time to take a break. I just got super emotional there for a second. We'll take a break. And then when we come back, I think we can start to talk about collaboration. And I saw something, especially in the context of, one, collaboration in general. And then I also want to talk about it in the context of capitalism, because I've seen or read somewhere that you don't believe in a capitalist society. So I want to talk a little bit about that too, in the context of collaboration and what that means, sure. Like wealth creation, economic empowerment, and all that.
Sure thing.
Okay, so let's take a break. Let me catch my breath, and we will be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. And of course, there's the 2 Michelin-starred Blanca tucked away in the garden for truly daring diners. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
All right, so we're back. Before we go into this idea of collaboration, I want to talk about capitalism in that context also. Tapiwa had mentioned earlier Heritage Day in South Africa, and I wanted him to share his thoughts on that. I remember it so well, and even quote-unquote celebrating that in the context of being in corporate South Africa, if you will. It was interesting for me to watch as an outsider. So I would love to hear your perspective on that.
So I'm going to give a comparison to contextualize it in a different way for, well, the only place I can think of is America, right? So I think February, you have Black History Month, right?
Yeah. Yep.
So for me, there's a time where Black Day was important, Black Month was important. There's a time where Heritage Day was important to, you know, change the course of the conversation to try and empower people, whatever, acknowledge our existence, right? But for me, this thing is on there's a timeline, and we can't keep making exceptions of ourselves. And what I mean by that is, by the mere fact of having Black History Month, the mere fact of having Heritage Month or Heritage Day, you're saying every other time of the year, it's okay to ignore us. It's okay to not be a priority. It's okay to take time off from being Black, from being African. And for 1 month in September and for 1 day on the 16th, we shall be as blackety black as we possibly can be black.
Yeah. Right?
And to me, that reinforces that thing of when you say you want to go for African food, or you want a suit made from African print, you are making a point of saying we are the weirdo on this continent. You don't go to Italy and ask for Italian food. You have food. You don't go to Japan and you don't ask for fish. You have sushi or sashimi, whatever, right? Their language describes their food. They don't make, oh, today we're having Japanese food. It's Japanese day. Right? They don't make a big hoo-ha about it. They'll make a weird exception to say, oh, I feel like going for Italian because I'm in Japan. Right? We on the continent are in the habit, and I'll speak to my part of the continent because I'm familiar with this aspect of the continent, right? We're in the habit of saying, well, this plant is called impepo, argument's sake, right? Oh, then someone white is like, oh, what is that? And you're like, oh, it's like African sage. It's like sage, but African, you know, it's black. It's but the converse would never be true, right? Or rarely would be true, right? The inverse, sorry. You don't go to Italy and they say, oh, this is gnocchi. What's gnocchi? Oh, it's like Italian maguigna, or it's like Italian whatever, right? They'll just say, it's gnocchi. You learn how to pronounce the word, no matter how difficult it is. Stroopwafel, schnitzel, Kaiser steak, whatever, Kassler steak, whatever. Right? You learn the word. But when we always make this concession to say, oh, shame, they're poor little delicate tongues that can't access this information. How do I make this an approximation so you get it? As opposed to saying, this is who we are, get with it. So this Heritage Day thing stirs up similar sentiments, stirs up similar emotion in me. It's saying the other 11 months of the year belong to whiteness. And this 1 month, ooh, finally we can breathe. I shall go wear my kitenge. I shall wear my shuka. I can, you know, finally be black or be African. Right? And I know its inception, there was a point to it. But at some point, we have to let go and just say, oh, I'm going to go out for food. Or oh, what kind of food are you having? Or oh, I'm going to have Xhosa food. I'm going to have Zulu food. I'm going to have Pedi food. Not to say I'm going to have this homogenous African food full of nonsense that's not really from me as well. Right? Like, there's this big thing for Heritage Day to do like a braai. And a braai is essentially cooking by fire. And I'm like, I grew up cooking by fire. Every day was braai day. Right? Because I was... My stews were by fire. Baking, we did baking by fire in the earth. Toasting, popping popcorn by fire in a pan. You know that pan that stays outside? It's never, it's always seasoned. It's never washed.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So what do you mean this is part of Heritage Day and not any other day? That's part of my heritage, period. That's part of being black, right? And so I'm really against this idea. And I celebrated Heritage Day once, that first event 2 years ago. I don't do it again because it makes an exception. And now that Tapi Tapi has been established as the place you can get African ice cream, I'm taking the African out of the name. It's Tapi Tapi ice cream. You come here and you have Tapi Tapi ice cream. Oh, what flavors do you have today? Oh, I have this flavor from Senegal. This is Cafe Touba. Oh, I have this flavor from Ghana. This is Kelewele. I have this flavor from Morocco. It's whatever, you know. Mate, the tea they do with the mint. Oh, this flavor from Kenya. It's Ndengu and Chapati. Oh, this, you know, whatever, right? And I don't tokenize myself because it's done the job. I've got people's attention. They now know I'm a Afrocentric space. I don't have to keep declaring this fact. Because what's next? I want another person to open an equivalent of Tapi Tapi in their neighborhood that does frozen yogurt, that does ice cream, do a better job than I can. Oh, actually, I only do South African flavors of ice cream. That's even better. Because now you're talking about eating locally. Yeah. Right? No, no, no. I do Western Cape Province versions of ice cream or dumplings or... whatever traditional foods that you have, your rupizas, your ratata, your umlekwa, whatever, right? That's what we need to be looking at. How do we move away from saying we're an exception we get to enjoy from time to time to say we're normal and from time to time, 3% of all the restaurants in this city are not African food or not South African food. Once in a while, I'll go to Panarottis to have pizza or whatever the hell it is. That's my beef with Heritage Day.
No, it makes sense to me. It makes a lot of sense to me. And I, like, as you know, you were talking about it, one, this whole idea of renaming our foods to appease others, right? Like, sometimes you'll post something and you'll say, this is, I don't know, what's an example? Actually, I did post something recently called tatale. It's a Ghanaian, it's called tatale in Ghanaian dialect, language, whatever. And and then I caught myself, like, I described it in English, if you will, like calling it a spice. So it's a plantain dish, like made with, you use super ripe plantains and then you add different spices and you fry them, almost comes out like plantain, round, circular, like what do you call it, pancake like. And so there's always that instinct to say, this is tatale, and then not just, and leaving it at that for people to discover themselves or whatever, but you feel the whatever it is to say, okay, like I need to
explain,
describe
it
in English so that people, explain it further so people get it, which is actually sad.
You know what it is? We've lost the vocabulary for some of these things, right? So the vocabulary that we have is the English, is the French, is the Italian, based on our colonial legacy on the continent, and the Portuguese, right? So your default is like, oh, whenever I make a dough that I then cook in oil and it puffs up and I use yeast, I've made a dumpling, right?
Right, right, yeah.
But, what I encourage people to do, and what I myself do from time to time, is I put time aside to find old vocabulary. If it doesn't exist, make it yourself, right? Language is beautiful in that way. If enough people adopt it, it is now part of the language. It's now part of the lexicon, whatever people say, right? So because I work in ice cream, I do a lot of dessert-centric neologisms where I come up with new words that describe, for argument's sake, ice cream itself, right? So my sugar cones, I call them dendere, and dendere is a nest. Because when I look at it, it looks like a nest with an egg in it. When you look at a scoop inside a sugar cone, right? And people are like, oh, what's a dendere? And I'm like, oh, here's a dendere. But what is it? Here it is. This is what it is. It's a dendere. And you insist. And you command the space and say, oh, but what is it like? Can you explain to me in English? Yeah, the English word for it is dendere. If you want to use in a sentence in English, say dendere. I was eating dendere earlier on. Because we do that with every other culture and every other language. We insert non-English terms. If you are an English-speaking nation, you insert non-English-speaking terms in respect of the origin of that thing, the origin of that word. So why not for ourselves? So if the language doesn't exist, we are going to have to create it. And that's what I mean by, like, this is a community effort. Over time, normalize. Even my hashtags are in Shona. Because next time you're looking for rotata, you're going to come across tapi tapi and you find a recipe for it because I've left it there for you to find it. Not because I'm trying to get likes. No, I want you to be able to access that information. If you want useful information, you're going to have to look using the words that those people associate with that thing. If I want a recipe for egusi, I don't Google Nigerian stew with bitter lemon or whatever, right? I search ugusi, right? Because you're going to find a Nigerian recipe written by a Nigerian person who grew up with this thing. Versus you end up with like the Spruce Eats or like the kitchen, Jamie Oliver's take on ugusi. You don't want that thing. You want the original thing.
Yeah. So I think we will probably make this like part one of this conversation because we've covered so much. And I think people will need to take it in, digest it before we move on to the second half of our conversation. So this is the end of part one of our conversation. And then I guess tune in next week for part two.
Thank you for listening to Item 13, an African food podcast. If you like the show, Please subscribe, rate, and review us on your favorite podcast app. To keep up to date, follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Item 13 Podcast. Item 13 is powered by Simplecast. Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a non-profit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.